Accession number 31510, reel 2.
See it.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Were you much aware of what was happening in Europe as you were growing up and through the 30s?
Yes, and the, let's see. When I was about 15 or 16, I suppose, we were aware of what was going on. Yes, we were. But not deeply aware of it. We just knew that Germany was arming, and there was a threat of, from what we were told from the First World War, German, you know, the Squarehead and Sieg Heil and all the rest of it, yeah. And I think in the cinema, Gaumont British News used to show some of these rallies in Germany, but it didn't particularly worry us, no. Of course, when I joined up, there was a vast expansion of the services. Yeah. But it didn't worry us at all. I was in training at East Church, we filled sandbags and made gun emplacements. But we didn't really worry about it. We didn't think, oh, there's a war coming and all the rest of it. No. No.
Would you still have joined up if you had thought that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's right. You join up to serve on land, at sea, and in the air. So when they sent me to the Fleet Air Arm, that was part of my contract, wasn't it?
Could you explain a bit more about the process of joining up when you turned 18 then?
Yes, I was 17 when I joined up. I had to be 17 and a half. And I caught the 7 o'clock train from Eastleigh Station because I was staying with my grandmother. And I went to London. I went to the Air Ministry building. And there I was given a medical examination, and my friends at Eastleigh had said, you won't get into the Air Force because your eyes are not good enough. That was on the Monday I caught the train. On the Sunday I'd been to the cinema and put my glasses on and left the blessed thing in the cinema. So I thought, well, anyway, came to the eye test and I could read it. I used to do eye exercises, and I think that was the reason I could do it. And anyway, that was that. I passed through the medical, and we went to a sort of transit camp. I don't know whether it was Uxbridge, I can't remember, Uxbridge or some other place. Yes, I remember we had ice cream and cake for tea. Ice cream and cake. And from there we went to another place. Not Uxbridge. Not far from Uxbridge anyway. And there we took the oath and were sworn in. And I think a couple of days we stayed there. From there we went to Cardington, where the airship sheds are, or were, I suppose they're still there. Huge hangars, weren't they? Huge. And there was a train load of us, new recruits. And we got out of the train at Cardington, and the corporal said, "Get fell in, you bloody lot of pound notes." I can remember it now. and it was very hard training at the beginning. Cleaning kit and cleaning the floor of the hut, marching about the square, doing this, doing that. Arms drill, rifle drill. Clean your equipment, blankoing days in those days. The webbing equipment had to be blankoed. And it was a messy job. And all the brass parts had to be perfectly shining. And you'd spend the whole evening getting all ready. And when you went out on parade the next day, you had to leave it on the back of the bed, which had to be made up like an armchair. It was had three biscuits like that. We called them biscuits. And three blankets, two sheets, and pillow. And it had to be all done up properly so that you could sit in it like an armchair. So we used to leave all our blankoed equipment with shiny brasses and all that on the back. And when we'd finished square bashing, come back into the hut, and it was all thrown about all over the place. That's not good enough. And it was perfect. Still, live and learn, I suppose. So eventually we finished the square bashing, and there was a big passing out parade, and away we went to our various training places. I went to each church. And a friend of mine, I don't know where he went, little Irishman he was, Paddy Lang. And when we were in the Mediterranean on the ship, I went ashore in Gibraltar, and walking up the street, it was Paddy. Yeah, Paddy Lang. And he knew more about our ship than we did, because he was in the ops room. Yeah. He knew what was going on. And he said, when you go home, he said, will you take home some silk stuff that I bought for my mother and post it on to Ireland? I said, yes, of course I will. The customs man came aboard when we reached Liverpool, and he charged me a hell of a lot for all this silk stuff. Anyway, I send it on, and they received it in Ireland. And when I was away in Egypt, Paddy must have been Ibsley, near here, and he called at my mother's home. But I haven't seen him, not since Gibraltar. No, I don't know what happened to him. No. But he knew more about us than we did. Kept it to himself, of course. Yeah, but I wondered if he knew when we were going home, because he asked me to take the silk for him. Yeah. He didn't say you're going home or anything like that, but I've often wondered if he knew. Yeah, how far did we get?
Did you have any choice in becoming an armourer?
Oh, I needn't have become an armourer, no. I chose to be an armourer. Yeah, I could have been anything. I could have gone into engines or airframes. It was called fitters and riggers in those days. Or wireless, electrical. Yeah, a lot of the wireless people were air gunners as well. They used to wear a cartridge on the wrist, on the uniform, with wings on it. Like a 303 cartridge, like the one up there. And could have done that, you see. I did volunteer to go on the Bergen raid with the skewers. Two of us volunteered, two armourers. We went to the CO and said, look, if one of the tags, telegraphed air gunners, couldn't go, could we fit in? Because we could do the armament side. And he said, no, he said, you don't know anything about wireless, you see. So that was that. So we couldn't go. But I could have been anything, I think. Yeah. One of the chaps who lived in the same village as me went to Price School, joined the RAF about the same time as a clerk. He was a bright boy too. He was. And next I heard of him was in, well, after the war. He'd given up being a clerk and taken a pilot's course and been shot down and killed. So, you know, I could have been anything.
How long were you at East Church for?
6 months. 6 months, yeah. We went there at the end of 1938, I think. About September. We stayed there 6 months. When we finished training, I was posted to Ford, which is now an open prison. It wasn't much more in those days.
What did the training at East Church involve?
Pardon?
What did the training at East Church involve?
The training at East Church involved all aircraft armament. Guns, that's Browning, Vickers, Lewis, Vickers gas operated, Vickers K. Pistols, signal pistols, pyrotechnics, smoke floats and flame floats and signal distress marines and things like that, marine distress signals, signal cartridges, all bombs, because up to 500 pounds that was, gun sights, bomb sights, camera obscura, we did. Oh, what else? Well, pretty well. Oh, synchronization gear. Yeah, the Swordfish had that. The gun fired through the rotation area of the propeller. And there was a gear which worked from the engine through tubes of compressed oil and to a mechanism on top of the gun which fired the gun when the prop was in the right place, so that the gun only fired at the speed of the prop. It sounded rather slow. I was on a squadron 40 when I went back to the before I went back to the RAF, Fleet Arm Squadron with Swordfish, and one of them, one of the training pilots had fired the gun and the bullet had hit the prop. Well, he obviously hadn't put pressure on the oil, had to be under pressure, or might have been an old round, see, because the guns were tested for synchronization. The Browning guns in a Spitfire wouldn't be any good in a Gladiator. The gun had to be tested for synchronization. The ones in the skewers were not tested for synchronization because they were out in the main planes, so it didn't matter. Yes, all that. And I've forgotten a lot of it, I'm afraid. Yeah, all that kind of training. And from East Church I went to Ford, which was School of Naval Cooperation. The naval air gunners and training pilots used to come there. And instead of dropping, well, they did drop practice bombs, like that one out in the kitchen on the floor, didn't notice it. Just the nose part of it, the tail part gets blown off. They drop those on the ranges, or they used to fly over the camera obscura, and we used to attach stannic chloride canisters on bomb racks with an electrical charge, which blew the bottom of the container out, and that released smoke, so that when it flew over the camera obscura, the chap doing the plot could see the puff of smoke, and that's when he dropped the bomb. Then you could work out how close the bomb was to the target. Quarter of the square root of H. I remember that. The time it takes a bomb to fall. Quarter of the square root of the height. So from 1600 feet, it'll take 10 seconds on it. Yeah. That's it. There we are. So we did that. And the aircraft were sharks. The one before the swordfish. And swordfish. The rear gunner had the old-fashioned First World War gun mounting with elastic bands and on a swivel, you know. Oh dear, oh dear. Yeah, so in May 1939, the Navy took over the Fleet Air Arm. And then wherever there was an aircraft on a ship, there was an airman. Now that, that picture of the pyramids there, the chap who was with me was on the Sheffield long before I was in the Fleet Air Arm, and he was on the Illustrious as well. He was wounded on the Illustrious. That's why he was in Egypt. He was put ashore in hospital. Yeah, airman, of course. Here we are. And when the Navy took it over, they sent me and two other armourers to 800 Squadron, which was supposed to be on the Courageous. So we left Ford and went by train to Devonport and went aboard the Courageous. Strange enough, you could walk into the dockyard straight to the ship. No police or anything like that. Went aboard the Courageous, and we saw some sailors, and we said we'd come to join 800 Squadron. They said, "Not here, mate. Try the Furious." And she was up the dock a bit further. So we went to the Furious. Went on board and asked about 800 Squadron. And this sailor said, "Oh, there's one or two airmen up there," he said, "belonged to the squadron." So we went to see them. And there was a corporal in charge. And he said, "Oh, the squadron's left, gone to Worthydown." So, he said, "But you might as well wait here with us, because we're going soon." They were left behind to do the clearing up kind of thing. So that's what we did. We went by train to Worthydown. And I went across to see my aunt again, didn't I? Yeah. Yes, so 800 Squadron was there. And I started work on a skewer. And I was still working on the same skewer at the end of 1940. All that time. Yeah, same pilot. Yeah. Lieutenant Roper, his name was. And I think he had it was a joint name, Trevor Roper. There is a Trevor Roper in television, isn't there? Yeah, I wondered if they're related or not. I don't know. But in some of the books you'll find it, Roper is quoted as Rooper. And it wasn't, it was Roper. Anyway, I was his armourer all that time.
The crews had their own, each had their own particular aircraft, did they?
There were enough armourers for each armourer to have an aircraft, yeah. Now he was responsible for the guns, bomb carriers, all the armament stuff. But when it came to bombing up, or bombing up with a 100-pounder was easy, you could do it yourself. But with the bigger bombs, we all worked together. Didn't matter which aircraft we were doing. And it was the same with getting the aircraft up and down from the hangar to the flight deck. We all did it. There's no aircraft handlers or anything like that. Each person could do anything pretty well, except for the tail wheel. There was a kind of a handle with a fork in it, which would clip onto each side of the tail wheel, and it needed a bit of handling, especially when the aircraft were going onto the lift, because they had to go into the right place or else it would snag on the side, wouldn't it? And a chap called Sergeant Balmain used to do that, RAF Sergeant. But the rest of us could do anything. Yeah. Usually the riggers used to undo there was a handle at the stub end of the wing. He'd unscrew the handle and a great wide bolt would come down so that the wing could be folded back. They used to fold back and upwards, so that when the aircraft, say the fuselage was there in the middle, the wings would be like that, you see. And then when the armourer had to unload the guns, he'd have to stand between the fuselage and the wing and work at an angle. It was a bit awkward, that was. Yeah, but that was done in the hangar. There was no time to do it on the flight deck. You know, you got the aircraft down, and the lift went up as the next aircraft was about to touch down. It had to be that quick. In the South Atlantic, no, it didn't have to be that quick because of no air attack, but in Norway, yes, and Mediterranean. Yeah, each man could do the job. Yeah.
Were you still at Worthy Down then when war was declared?
No. No, we were at Worthy Down, and my pilot, that aircraft is wrong. I'll tell you about that in a minute. My pilot was going to go to Lym in Kent, in a minute. Yeah, so I said, can I go with you? Yes, he said. So I saw the chap in charge of the armourers and got permission from him as well. So off we went to Lym, and I didn't know why we went to Lym, but he got out and went to the office somewhere, and I sat in the cockpit and kept the engine going. And when he came back, I got out, he got in. And I'm not sure about this, but it could have been then when we picked up. No, it wasn't. That wasn't. No, we came back alone. We came back along the coast, all the way along the coast, and as far as Southampton, between Southampton and Portsmouth, then followed the railway line up to Worthy Down. I don't know why he went to Lym. But soon afterwards, the squadron moved to Lym. Yeah. We stayed there a few days, I know, because a couple of us went to Brighton. Then the squadron came back to Portsmouth, where we boarded the Ark. That's probably why we went to Lym, because when the Ark sailed, we sailed towards the Strait of Dover, and I suppose the squadron took off from Lym and landed on the ship. Yeah. So we went there and turned north into the North Sea, and there we did practice landings and striking the aircraft down and getting them up, blacking out the ship at night in preparation, I suppose. We used to go into the Firth of Forth late afternoon, and in the morning go out and exercise around Bass Rock and back again into the Firth of Forth. So we used to get a run ashore into Edinburgh, Queen's Ferry, North Queen's Ferry, Glasgow. Went to Glasgow one night. All night leave could be, was given then, you see, peacetime, and you could wear civilian clothes. Well, after the exercises there, we lost an aircraft there too. What was his name? Sub-Lieutenant Watson. They were doing dive bombing practice near Bass Rock, within sight of Bass Rock, and he didn't pull out, went straight in. We don't know why, but there was a huge column of smoke went up. You never believe there was so much smoke could come from that burning oil from the aircraft. Anyway, tag went as well, you know. I forget the tag's name now. No, I can't remember. Anyway, from there, you see, we moved up to Scapa Flow. And when we arrived at Scapa Flow, the squadron was told, at least ground crew was told, go get ready to go ashore. So we got our kit bags, hammock, toolbox, and a lighter came alongside, and we got into the lighter and they took us to St. Mary's, which is a landing place in Scapa Flow on Orkney. On the, yes, or, what's the name of the island? Mainland. So we got off at the jetty at St. Mary's, which is still there when I went back. Yeah, a few years ago now I went back. And, while we're on that subject, there was nothing in Scapa Flow either. No battleships, no warships, nothing. Empty. Anyway, we got off at St. Mary's and boarded some lorries, which took us to Hatstan, which is near Kirkcaldy. You know Kirkcaldy? You don't. You do not? No. Well, Kirkcaldy is a town here, and there's a causeway from the town to the next piece of land, and the Hatstan airfield was on there, but it wasn't an airfield. They just started building a hangar there. This was before the war. The road from Kirkcaldy to Stromness eventually went across the place where they were building the hangar, across the causeway, right? The ground was fairly level there. So there was nowhere for us to live, so we bedded down in a stone building right on the back of the cathedral, St. Magnus's Cathedral, and we used to walk up to the airfield every day. The aircraft landed on the road which led from Kirkcaldy to Stromness. They used the road as a runway, and we moved from the little wooden stone place behind the cathedral to a big wooden building a bit further back. And we moved in there, slept in there. War was declared while we were there. I had one of the ammunition tanks of my skewer out, and I was filling it with a new belt. Yeah, that's what I was doing. And that was that.